Shalom, and welcome to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I greatly appreciate you being with us today. With these podcasts, we hope to explore issues that touch us and our families in light of the revolution in longevity that is reshaping our Jewish world. And we appreciate your support. And you can follow us and listen to previous podcasts by going to our website, jewishsacredaging.com, as well as our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. We thank you and are grateful for any of your donations, which help further our work. And in that sense, I'm going to ask all of you to just take a second and see if you can remember the first time you may have heard this song.
Kayam Shechezarta Bi Nishmati Bechemla Bechemla Rabba Emunatecha Rabba Emunatecha Mode Ani Lefanecha Melechai Vekayam
Great pleasure. We welcome to this edition of Seekers of Meaning, Rabbi Dan Friedlander and Jeff Klepper, the founders and innovators of Kol B'Seder. That's one of their signature tunes. You may have remembered that song from a song session at a camp or from a service at your local synagogue. Danny, Jeff, welcome to Seekers of Meaning. It is great to have you with us. Thank you for being with us. How are you doing?
Thank you. And Chag Sameach to everyone.
Yes, as we're in the middle of Passover and the middle of our, hopefully on the downward trend or some curve on the coronavirus, we're all in different places with shiny faces from all over the country. So thank you for being here.
We should identify ourselves probably. So I'm Jeff.
And I'm Danny.
And you're Kol B'Seder. So this is a treat. It's the 50th anniversary, right?
Well, at the moment it's 49, but soon it will be 50.
How soon? When is your official anniversary date?
I think it was October of 71.
As soon as coronavirus is gone, it'll be 50 years.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In our hearts.
Anyway, originally, because of the coronavirus, you were scheduled to do a scholar in residence at a local Philadelphia congregation, Brith Achim and King of Prussia. But since everybody's had scholar in residence and teaching things delayed, from what we're hearing is that event is going to be postponed until the fall of 2020. But you are here, and we're very delighted to have you here. And so Mode Ani and the 50th anniversary. So I guess I want to start with an easy question. Where did you guys meet? Was it at camp? Danny?
It was at a nifty Northeast region regional event. somewhere in Connecticut or New Hampshire, where we were both on staff. We were both university students at the time, and Jeff was a song leader, and I was just a college helper on the event. And we ended up hanging out with one another. And then spent the summer, the next summer, driving to Colorado Springs, Colorado, for the Rocky Mountain Curriculum Planning Workshop.
Oh, God, I remember that.
Where we became very dear friends and decided maybe we could do some things together.
So, Jeff, what was the, was there a moment that this collaboration was really born? I mean, that you decided, hey, we could do this and take this on the road? What was there an aha moment in the birth of Colby Center?
Well, we've had decades of Danny's and my singing together for me to have constructed a mythology of our meeting, which I'm hoping is more real than myth.
epic.
But right? It has taught me the importance of the concept of Beshert, because when I graduated high school, I was waitlisted at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Right.
And I desperately wanted to go there because I had an older cousin who had gone there and had told me so many wonderful things about it. I lived in Albany, New York at the time. And so when the wait list came to me and I got that letter admitting me to Clark, I was thrilled. And from the moment I arrived in Worcester and went to the temple, Temple Emmanuel, that was the synagogue that Danny had been bar mitzvahed at. But not only that, he had two brothers in the youth group, and his mother taught Hebrew in the religious school. So from the moment I got to the synagogue and took out my guitar, because that was my job, I was the song leader of the temple, because Danny was going to school in Hartford, everyone said, "Do you know Danny?" And I thought, "Who is this Danny?" And, "Oh, Dan Freelander." And I knew his brothers. I just had never met Danny. So he was a little bit of a phantom until fate brought us together. And I think we started singing from the very, very moment we met. And we had good role models, because our role models were the Simon and Garfunkel and the Everly Brothers and John and Paul of the Beatles. So from the moment we started singing, we would use that sort of sacred repertoire as our, you know, our material. And we just sang and we harmonized.
And we had laboratories to use them in. Jeff was teaching at the Large Reformed Congregation in Worcester, and I was teaching at the Large Reformed Congregation in Hartford. And the music that we were given by the schools to teach was just awful. So we decided we'd write some of our own and try them out on the kindergarten and first, second, third graders and see if it stuck. And that's where a lot of our early songs came from.
So do you remember the first song that you collaborated, you wrote, you adapted? You remember?
It was probably Mow Down Knee.
I think it was.
Was it? Was it?
Because we had to teach religious school at 8:45 on a Saturday morning. And it is something to wake the children up, and singing Mow Down Knee Lefanecha, put them to sleep instead of waking them up. So we wrote Mow Down Knee Lefanecha. And now we have three generations of parents and grandchildren and campers who learned that in their early childhood centers. And my granddaughter comes back from Tav Shabbat singing Mow Down Knee.
So, yeah, I know that song.
No, she sings Mow Down Knee. We sang Mow Down Knee.
Well, she corrects me.
But I'll tell you this, just continuing the story. After we wrote the first couple of songs, the following summer, we were both at camp at the Joseph Eisner Camp in Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
Oh, I heard of that camp.
And yes, it has a long and storied history.
It's not a bad camp. It's not Harlem, but it's an
Well, it was the only camp we knew at the time.
Okay.
And, well, except for the Kutz camp, but that's a memory now. And we found that late because Danny was a unit head and I was the song leader. Because we didn't have bunk responsibilities, at night we were put on the security staff, which was called the Shmirah.
Shmirah, right. And we all been there.
And because we were the non-attached senior staff, we were called Super Shmir, you see. So we would be, you know, it's like being in a police station house. You know, you're waiting for an emergency call to come in. And we had a lot of time on our hands. So we decided that I would bring out my guitar and Danny would have a prayer book in his hands and he would flip the pages of the prayer book until something interesting popped out. And then we would turn on a tape recorder and we would start singing, literally improvising as I played guitar. And out of that came Lo Alecha Hamacha Ligmor and a lot of other songs.
And we would because Jeff had to lead a song session at lunch and dinner every day, we'd write a song at night. Jeff would try it out in the dining room the next day. And then we'd go back and edit it and rewrite it and fix it. And if after two or three days the group liked it, we'd keep singing it. If not, we dropped it. So we had loads of songs we started, but
that never made it. Never sells to
the very discerning taste of the campers there.
No, that's actually, like you said, it's the best laboratory because if a couple hundred kids after lunch don't sit, you know, that'll tell you right away. It's instant verification, validation, or thumbs down. So Lo Alecha was a big lunch song.
Lo Alecha, that was an early song.
Yeah.
Tell me mena,
the thing I think is really important. We, Dan and I, grew up in the 50s and 60s when people sang. I remember taking long trips on buses and cars.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and what do? Right. You sing.
You sang.
Kids don't do that today. They plug in headphones and play video games.
Right. I really haven't flashed on that memory of youth group trips until you just mentioned sitting in a school bus or a coach singing something.
100 bottles of beer.
Yeah, right. The wheels of the bus go round. Something insidious thing like that.
But quite seriously, I think out of that culture.
No, yes,
it was true. A culture of singing that we don't have today. It's really unfortunate.
And also was the time the folk rock birth and protest songs. And it was you're right. It was a different, people looked at each other and sang with and to each other instead of being plugged in.
And we were trying, you know, we were writing these songs. This is the early 1970s. And so we're still in the post Six-Day War euphoria, where we were trying to recapture Hebrew as a part of, or introduce Hebrew into the Reform tradition, which did not do a lot of Hebrew when we were in elementary school and high school.
Correct. So
this is the beginning of a real change moment in the Reform movement, moving away from singing English language hymns and English language folk songs into Hebrew language things that had the same sound as the American pop and folk melodies we were singing, but were in Hebrew.
Well, did you guys ever, I know you were, you know, the scene in the bunk at night and with flipping through the prayer book and, you know, harmonizing to, you know, Micha Mocha or something like that. But did you ever have a desire, and I don't know this, so to get off the Jewish music front and do something, you know, in the secular world, like a Simon and Garfunkel. Did you ever picture yourself like Simon and Garfunkel type?
In my mind.
Yes. And Jeff's strong fantasy life. Yes. I was working for the union by then, and I was able to play out all sorts of other Jewish fantasies. So I never really, the one time is when one of our managers called us and asked if we wanted to be booked. This is when they're just starting the show, The Voice. And we're looking for some people to sing where you wouldn't be seen until someone pushed a button and turned around. And so they submitted our tapes. We didn't get on, but that would have been an interesting place to be.
That's pretty cool. So listen, you guys really, as you mentioned it, were the forefront of the revolution in synagogue music and Jewish music. It was born, I think it's safe to say, out of the camp experience, which we remember, for those of us who were in pulpits at that time, the gradual introduction of camp melodies as opposed to God is in his holy temple. Or behold, it is the springtime of the year, which was a big number where they Knesset Israel in Philadelphia in Elkins Park. It was a big, especially around the opening of a baseball season. So you guys were really part of that. Walk me through what it was like in the beginning of that as you began to put this together, go on the road, sing at biennials, conventions, synagogues, and how the generations viewed this type of new Jewish music. What was it like there in those days?
I could talk for hours about it.
Well, take a couple
minutes. We'll just keep it to 2 minutes. Yeah, let me set the scene for you. Long before Dan and I went to camp, we were listening to the radio and records and going to folk music concerts or Broadway shows or watching the Ed Sullivan Show and the Beatles would come on. And all of those musical influences, I think, affected us in a very powerful way. And that was happening all over society. You talked about the protest songs of the Vietnam War, or even before that, of civil rights. And Pete Seeger was an enormous influence on me because it taught me that one person on a stage with a guitar could change a room full of people, not just a room full, but a Carnegie Hall full of people, and give them hope and give them courage in the face of the terrible things that were happening in the world. When I went to synagogue, I would sit through services, but I was never moved emotionally. So the idea of taking this musical material and using it in my Jewish life was an epiphany, but it didn't come from us. It came from a couple of people who came before us, notably Debbie Friedman, who took the same sounds that we were hearing, the music of Peter, Paul, and Mary especially, and crafted it, changed it for sure in a way that would be meaningful to a synagogue. But she created something new, and we were coming up just a year or two behind Debbie. And we, you know, she was the trailblazer, and we followed.
And you need to look at the 1970s was a fascinating time period in the Jewish community, because we were feeling very secure. And the camps were booming. The youth movement was booming. The tail end of the baby boom was sort of moving through our system. So it was boomtown all around. And so there was a big audience for the material we were writing. And also at the time, Nifty started putting out these record albums called Songs Nifty Sings.
Oh, God, I remember that.
Which allowed, you know, every year or two, there'd be a new album, and it allowed songs that we or Debbie Friedman or others put on there to get disseminated across the entire musical system, Jewish music system. So there was all of a sudden a way to distribute this music. There wasn't just you had to be at that camp. So it became movement music, not just Swig music or Eisner music or Harlem music or Kutz music. And that was one big important change during the 70s. But the synagogue music scene was very, very slow to change, and the cantorate was very, very threatened by this. We don't really see breakthrough into the larger movement until we get into the 80s.
Right.
10 years is very much a youth phenomenon.
We were very controversial at the time. Now, maybe not Danny and I specifically, but cantors who I understand what cantors were going through. If I was in my 50s and had to completely change my repertoire from the music that I had sung for 20 years into this strange new folk rock concept that kids were listening to, or whatever it is, I would go crazy. So I have a lot of Rachmanis in my heart for cantors who were at the time very critical of the new music. That doesn't mean that it wasn't necessary at the time. I believe it was, but it was a little bit of knocking down the temple wall, so to speak.
And with Debbie of blessed memory, and the two of you, what other, you know, looking, but what other individuals traveled in this milieu would you say were part of this music revolution?
I think it started with Shlomo Carlebach, frankly.
Really?
Sure. If you remember in the late 60s, the only sort of upbeat Jewish music we heard at camp was in Hebrew was Shlomo Carlebach creations. Then the Hasidic song festivals of the late 60s and early 70s, it gave us Al Shlosha Devarim or Oseh Shalom Bimromav, really wonderful pieces from Israel, which we integrated. But and even people like the composer Mike Isaacson, who eventually sort of rejected where this was taking him, but he wrote the first Nifty folk service in the late 60s and early 70s. And some of that material still gets used today.
And now a lot of the, I would venture to say the majority of the students at the cantorate, at least in our movement, are products of the camping system. So they know this music, it's in their DNA, so to speak. And the rabbis too, the rabbinic students too, many of whom have come through the camping system, they know this music too. So with the revolution, and like you said, Danny, by the time we get to the 80s, this is becoming more and more normalized.
Best,
yeah, if we can use that. Where do you see synagogue music now? Because it's obviously changing, or is it? Where you guys have your hands on the pulse of a lot of this stuff that's going on now. Where are we in the normative synagogue music world right now? Are we in a plateau? Are we about to launch into a new level of creativity? Are there new Dannys and Jeffs running around that you're aware of? It's a different marketing, it's CDs and whatever.
But there are wonderful people composing now. There's wonderful new material coming out. What's missing is the platform to share that.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, again, I referenced the Songs Nifty Sings albums, which would be a compilation of many different composers that would come out periodically, and we'd listen to them over and over, decide which songs we wanted and we wanted to teach. But with the end of, you know, you cannot fund CDs anymore. You put things online, so people tend to listen to what they like to listen to, and their exploration is not sort of forced on them by full albums. Or the lack of conferences where new people could get stages. I think about the CAGE conferences, the educator conferences, or the regional biennials, where young composers, young songwriters could get up and perform their things and sell their wares, sell their CDs or records or cassettes. And there are ways of spreading music which are different today. It's not that they don't exist. It's just a very different world.
I see it perhaps a little bit differently. What Danny said about CAGE, C-A-J-E, the Coalition for the Alternatives in Jewish Education, yeah, I think that was important, but it was a different time. In the 1980s, you could get 2,000 or 3,000 people in a room at a CAGE conference or a biennial, and someone would get up, whether it's Debbie Friedman or us or Craig Taubman, and sing one or two or three of their latest songs. And then people would take those songs home and teach them. What I see happening now reminds me more of the Chavura movement, in that you have smaller groups, minyanim, cells, if you will, CELL cells in different parts of the country. And people are, I think, using music to create more intimacy in the worship and the activities and ceremonies that they're doing in their homes. So you have a number of organizations, one of whom is the Rising Song Institute, which is located in Philadelphia. And they hold small group sessions with 20, 30 people, or maybe 100, or maybe 200 people. And from then, it's sort of like Ki Mitzion Tetzé Torah. People fan back out into the country and teach these songs. So I think it's going to be another generation until we see the fruits of that.
In the contemporary synagogue setting, which is also, as we know, undergoing radical shift and change, Do you think the music now has usurped the sermon and even the liturgy, the prayer, as a major vehicle of grabbing and holding people's attention?
Absolutely, and group singing in particular. Now, think about what we've been watching the last several weeks, and you watch the online services.
Right.
So you still get the text, the teachings still come through, but the feeling of group, of community that emerges from people singing together, just doesn't work as well on Zoom. You can't sync that together. So you can listen to the performer, the person leading it, and you still hear the music, but your voice is missing. So that's the real challenge with online worship right now, is you can watch, and it can be inspirational. And the teachings can be inspirational, but the music, which is what holds the whole system together, from my perspective, ends up being performance. There's no way around it. And that's that was the revolution that I think we tried to spark and contribute to, is to performance synagogue music and make it a group activity, just to rethink the chazan as from being the prayer performer to being the prayer facilitator.
You might call it democratizing Jewish music.
Yeah, that's a good way of expressing it, actually. The Shabbat experience, in many cases, as you've alluded to, has transformed. Talk to me about when the High Holiday music experience will be transformed.
I think it's possible. Happening. It's happening really? Slowly.
In what way?
I think that if you went to High Holiday services in a medium-sized urban center like Philadelphia, Boston, LA, you would, and certainly New York City, you would find a very different service from the one you would have seen in 1975 or even 1985. Some of the music is old and traditional, and that's fine. That's important. And much of the music has a fresh sound. I use this word advisedly, but it almost has a Broadway sound to it. And I think that the style that you hear in the best music of Broadway is a style that appeals to many people in a way that rock and roll or folk or jazz does not. And that style of music, I think, is starting to, I won't say take over, but is certainly an important part of services. I do want to mention one point. When I was a student cantor in the late 1970s, and I ascended the Bema with a guitar, you would see eyebrows being raised.
Right. I remember those days.
And some people loving it, some people hating it, people debating and arguing and so on and so forth. And at the end of the service, the comments I would get about the music had to do with using a guitar. No one would have dreamed of having a band, drums and bass and saxophone and piano on a bima in a synagogue in 1975.
Correct.
But because things change and evolve, it happened in the 1980s. In New York City, especially, and in Los Angeles. And now I haven't heard of a reform or conservative synagogue that does not have an ensemble.
Let me ask you a question. Danny, what, because you've also done, because of your special work as you travel for the union, what do you think that the mega church phenomenon and that blossomed also in the 70s and 80s and 90s, do you think their use of music, which was real performance? I mean, I was at mega churches with 100-piece band and, great singers. Do you think that had that trickled down into our community too, as there was a greater meshing of neighborhoods? And
well, I do think there's strong influence, but I don't think it's from performance. I think it's from a bit of professionalism.
Okay.
The professionalism towards video work or towards sound work or towards the rehearsal of the band, where it wasn't just an organist and a cantor, but rather there's a whole musical system. But the most important thing that we learned from the mega churches was group participation. And I really remember the first time I visited one of the mega churches, there was a series of microphones over one section of the congregation.
Right.
I asked why. They said, "Oh, well, the regulars tend to sing that sit there, and they sing really loud, and we take their voices, then we mix it so that all around the outside of the sanctuary, people think everyone around them is singing. So it suggests to them that they're supposed to sing as well." And that's a revolution, to empower the congregation to believe that they're supposed to sing, not just watch the officiants of the performers. And I think that's a huge contribution.
know, and it does change the worship. I mean, we've all been in synagogues where there's still the congregation's going to sit there with their hands folded and say, okay, you sing and we'll just sit here. And then the difference when the congregation is engaged. And I've been to some unbelievably wonderful worship services where there's almost no talking. It's they just start singing, and they sing almost the entire service, and it changes the whole atmosphere of the worship experience. Before we start running out of time, this is a horrible question, so please forgive me. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite of all the songs that you did? Do you have a favorite?
I have two,
and they are.
Still get moved to tears when I hear large groups singing Shalom Rav. We wrote the song in 1974, and it's become like a Misenai tune. People think it's a traditional Jewish melody. And that's very satisfying. And then my other favorite is Jeff's Yesh Kochavim, the
that's a beautiful
poem, which just transmits so much emotion and feeling, and is so healing. Yeah, those are my favorites.
There are stars up above, so far away we only see their light. long, long after the star itself is gone. And so it is with people that we loved. Their memories keep shining ever brightly, though their time with us is done. But the stars that light up the darkest night, these are the lights that guide us as we live our days. These are the ways we remember.
Yesh Kochavim, I'm glad you mentioned that. Jeff, do you have a favorite?
I've had a hand in composing between 200 and 300 songs, and probably more than that. And each one has a story. The ones that tend to mean the most to me are the songs that I sort of dashed off in 5 or 10 minutes. I mean, that's pretty rare that that happens. It does happen occasionally. The ones that came easily and that I dismissed, oh, that's nothing. You know, that's really simple. And I remember being at my synagogue in Evanston, Illinois in the 1990s, I think, and wanting to write a simple prayer for the kids to sing in religious school. And I took the prayer Ahava Rabbah from the morning service between the Baruch Hu and the Shema, and wrote a little poem of 3 lines. Open up our eyes. Open up our eyes. Teach us how to live. Fill our hearts with joy and all the love you have to give. Now, it's not Beethoven's Fifth, but or Handel's Messiah, I'm being facetious. It was just a simple little song. But to watch, as I sang it around the country, to hear it sung back to me, and then people write letters and emails about how much that silly little song, I know it's not silly, it's a prayer, but
us how to live, fill our hearts with joy and all the love you have to give. Gather us in peace as you lead us to your name, and we will know that you are one. We will know that you are one.
It's those kinds of things that mean a lot to me. I'll just give you one other example. When I was in Israel, I wrote a prayer to HaPorei Sukkot Shalom from the end of Hashkivenu. And it was nothing fancy. It had 3 or 4 chords. And frankly, the idea of it probably subconsciously came from James Taylor. Subconsciously, what? I was living in Israel. I was homesick for America. So it was the sound of the music that made me feel good, that came into my mind and into my fingers on the guitar. So I never thought much of the song, but the more I sang it, people told me what it meant to them, and now it's become one of my favorites.
Aruch ata, ata donai hapore sukat shalom. Shalom aleinu ve'al kol amo Yisrael. Aruch ata, ata donai hapore sukat shalom. Shalom.
Dan Friedlander, Jeff Klepper, happy anniversary, the 50th of Kol B'Seder. Thank you for all that you have given to our entire community. And as Danny said, generations now, and you've helped transform synagogue music. So for that, there are no words. So thank you very, very, very much. We wish you much joy and health and success in this next chapter of your life. And keep on keeping on. So thank you very much. Thank you for joining us on today's Seekers of Meaning. We really appreciate it very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Richie.
Thanks.
Thank you. And to all of you again, thank you for listening to this edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. A reminder that you can follow us on our website, jewishsacredaging.com, our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging, as well as a special Jewish Sacred Aging podcast page on Facebook. And if you'd like to make a tax-free donation to help further our work, please feel free to go to our website and click on the donation icon. For suggestions and comments and requests for consultations, let me know. Send it to rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. These podcasts are recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and produced by the amazing Steve Lubetkin. Again, thank you for being with us, and we look forward to greeting you on the next Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. Todah and Shalom.